Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we sit down with authors, historians, and filmmakers, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Jeff Shara, who is an award-winning author of multiple military history books, and he's the author of today's book, The Shadow of War, a novel of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's also served on the Board of Governors for the American Battlefields Trust, which if you haven't checked them out yet, go check them out. They're really awesome. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I love talking about what I do, so this is fun.
Perfect. This is the place to be then, because we love talking about what you wrote about. I just have to say, you are quite well known for writing these immersive dialogues and these characters. And how did you capture all of that? These characters of JFK, Khrushchev, how did you do that?
Well, I get asked probably at every book I've done. These are novels. I mean, by definition, they're fiction. The reason they're fiction is because of the dialogue. I mean, the names, dates, places, all of that is accurate. Every event happened. I mean, they're real history, but they're novels. It has to be called a novel because you're there and you're hearing the words, hearing the dialogue. I hate to use the word, it's almost a mystical thing for me to get to that point. I do an enormous amount of research, and when I, if I'm reading about a certain character, for example, pick somebody, Benjamin Franklin, I'll do a huge amount of research on that character, and I will get to the point eventually where I feel like I know him. And I have to get to that point or it doesn't work, because then I'm putting words in his mouth. And I've gotten people say to me, how dare you put words in the mouth of Robert E. Lee? I mean, I've heard that. Okay, fair enough. I mean, challenge accepted. If I dare to do that, they had better be the right words. I mean, they had better be true to the character, accurate to the character, or the whole story falls apart. So I'm very careful about that. That's one of the most important things. But to answer your question, how do I get there? I don't know. It just feels at some point I'm in the room with these characters and I'm just writing what I hear them saying.
Fantastic.
I know that sounds weird.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It sounds like just like a writer, not just a historian, but a writer. And you do it so well. So, yeah, that was actually one of the things that made the book stand out to me above a lot of other books that I read, historical military books. It was really fantastic. And the audiobook, I listened to the audiobook. Really, really good. Okay. Let's jump into this a little bit. Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's talk a little beforehand. Let's talk about the Bay of Pigs invasion, which is key to understanding why JFK was so hesitant to have another Bay of Pigs disaster. Can you tell us just a little bit about what was the Bay of Pigs invasion and why was it a disaster?
I mean, JFK is new, brand new to the job. He's been there for a couple of months. He is handed this mission, the plans for this mission by the CIA from Eisenhower's people. Eisenhower just sort of handed off to him. Kennedy, because he is so new, he's really nervous about this. But the CIA keeps telling him, no, this is great. This is going to be slam dunk. It's going to be wonderful. And he believes them to his lack of credit. I mean, he's not the expert. They are. So he assumes that they're the experts. They know what they're talking about. And when the event actually happens, Kennedy realizes that, this is a disaster and we should not have listened to the CIA. The military is telling him we should not listen to the CIA. The CIA totally excludes the American military from this entire operation. They're so territorial, they want to keep it for themselves. And that's sort of a problem because the military could have helped. I mean, they could have done all kinds of things to sort of smooth over the problems. They weren't allowed to. So Kennedy realizes actually about three quarters of the way through the actual invasion, the actual event, he pulls the plug. I mean, he has American planes ready to go in and bomb Castro's planes on the ground. No, we're not doing that. He has an American destroyer off the beach who's supposed to kind of rescue the Cubans. And nope, we're not doing that either.
Wow.
Well, that's two things. One, it's Kennedy finally recognizing that he needs to do the right thing. The other thing is he's abandoning all these Cuban Americans, these expatriates who are there to try to take their country back, 1,400 of them. He abandons them on the beach, and there, and 1,100 of them are captured. So it's a just all around horrible situation.
Wow.
And of course, Kennedy afterward is very definitive, and in his regard for the CIA, he doesn't. He tells them, he fires all the senior people, Ike's people, and he puts he tolerates them a little bit, but he says he will never take their advice again on any kind of major operation.
That makes sense. That makes total sense. And it doesn't seem like wild to even today to think of that kind of thing. But that's a really good explanation. Thank you for that.
Say, going forward, after Bay of Pigs, now Kennedy, it's like once bitten, twice shy. He's very careful about any plans, anything. So when they detect that the Russians have missiles in Cuba, he's hesitant at first to like, here we go again. So, he's, to his credit, he's very careful. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right. Who wouldn't be? That seems pretty smart. Who wouldn't be careful? Honestly, it would be a little sus if you weren't careful. So, okay, that brings us to we're on the ground in Cuba. Or we're not on the ground, but on the ground in Cuba, Russia is doing all the secret-y, shadowy stuff. They're aware, I wanted to ask, this is so wild. They're aware that the U.S. has the Monroe Doctrine policy, which is just our president, 1823, said, President Monroe was like, you know what, Europe, don't come over here, that side of the world, do not come over here and interfere. We won't go over there and interfere. Don't even try coming over here. But they did. Russia did. Why risk the ire of the U.S.? Why do that?
Well, if you take the Russians' point of view, which is important, it explains why they did what they did. They weren't looking to just bait the United States, or they weren't thinking about the Monroe Doctrine. They were thinking about, as Khrushchev says, and he's walking with his wife along his vacation home along the shores of the Black Sea. And he says to her, look across there. See that across that water there? Over there, there are missiles aimed at me. And he said, why shouldn't I have missiles, close to the United States? I mean, it's fair's fair.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to argue that. The problem is they make some mistakes along the way. They keep it secret for too long so that it looks like they're trying to get away with something. The logic from the Russians' point of view is, hey, you got missiles in Italy, Turkey, and why don't we have missiles in Cuba? I mean, it's sort of seems reasonable when you hear it that way.
Yeah, from just like a human-to-human point of view, from their point of view, we started the whole thing because we were up in Turkey having all these missiles pointed at them. And they're like, excuse me. And it was more than Turkey, you're saying? There were Italy and...
Yeah, you had NATO. I mean, and so a lot of the NATO countries that didn't have their own missiles, like Britain and France, they wanted us to help. They wanted us to, offer them some security. We did. Now, of course, a lot of this is a Cold War thing. After World War II, when we developed the bomb, and then eventually the Russians got the bomb 4 years later, 1949, it sort of escalated from there, where it was sort of tit for tat.
Yeah.
And we had the upper hand, but we had the upper hand in a lot of ways. The American public never really knew that the number of missiles, atomic bombs, that we had was astronomical compared to the number the Russians had. The Russians did not have intercontinental ballistic missiles, something they could fire in Moscow and it would end up in Chicago. They didn't have that. They were working on it. They were trying to get them as fast as they could, but that's why they wanted Cuba, because in Cuba they can put medium range and short range missiles and they'll be very effective. And, I don't think we really understood that at the time because a lot of people in the government, Kennedy They were aware that we had a huge advantage over the Russians, over their missile count. It was just a question, you know, for some reason, I don't really understand this, the public wasn't told. You know, we didn't tell the American public, you know, we're in great shape here. You know, we got them outgunned like crazy. For some reason, because I remember as a kid hearing about the missile race, the gap between one country and the other. And, you know, we were totally, as I was a little kid, we were totally scared to death that the Russians were going to bomb us. I mean, we actually believed that.
And nobody knew they were prancing around with friggin' sawdust in their missiles and all, like, they're fake. Like, nobody really knew that at the time.
No, not really. I mean, I don't know
how
we got the information that sort of the counts of the missile. I mean, how do you know how many? Who is it that counts them? I don't know. But it was done and it was fairly accurate. And it even carried over to when the Russians started putting stuff in Cuba. And when we caught them, we knew exactly what they were doing based on the size of the crate. They knew what kind of missile it was.
Whoa.
You know, the people that were expert in that kind of business. You know, I would not.
That's impressive.
We were glad somebody did.
So is that why, like, because the public wasn't aware Russia has sawdust in their missiles, we really outgunned them. Was that why people were protesting the U.S. telling Russia to get out of Cuba, like, because they just didn't want an escalation? We just weren't aware of how much power we had?
Well, to a lot of people, I think that you used the right word, an escalation. I think a lot of people saw this purely as an escalation. You know, they didn't want to hear about the logic of it and the military side of it and all and Kennedy's side of it. This was just like, you're a warmonger. Kennedy's a warmonger. You know, he's going to blow up the world because he's being heavy-handed, ham-handed and clumsy about how he's dealing with the Russians. Well, that sounds good, you know, but you know, for the people on the inside, that wasn't the case at all.
That makes sense if you're terrified of escalation to protest against it. Now you look back and you're like, why were people protesting? But at the time, that seems like it would make sense from the American public's point of view. I wanted to ask a little bit about, you mentioned Eisenhower. I did want to ask about that. Like, he seems like he loomed pretty large in Russia still at the time when JFK was elected. Why does it seem like Russia didn't respect JFK the way they did Eisenhower?
Oh, that's an easy one. First of all, Ike, look who Ike was. You know, look what he had done in World War II. I mean, he's the top dog.
Yes, huge.
And he won the war, and I'll argue that with anybody. So now he's the president of the United States. So inherently, there's a respect. You know, there's the idea that, you know, he's accomplished. He's paid his dues. He knows what he's talking about. And he was a decent president. He wasn't perfect. But, I mean, when it comes to civil rights, he was ahead of his time. I mean, he really did see the interstate highway system. I love pointing that out to people.
Yeah,
it's
huge.
Ike was responsible for there being an interstate highway system.
It's huge.
So when Kennedy comes along, I mean, Kennedy, first of all, is much younger. I mean, Kennedy's only, I think, 43 when he takes office. And he doesn't know, compared to Ike, he doesn't know anything. I mean, he's very inexperienced. I mean, he's been a congressman. And he was sort of handed that job by the machinations of his father, who had all the influence in the world around Eisenhower, around Washington. So he comes in, you know, it would be really easy to say that Kennedy bought the presidency, and people do say that.
Oh, interesting.
And Nixon said that because Nixon lost the election. But I don't know if that's true or not. In hindsight, I think Kennedy was a pretty good president. But he simply did not. I don't. I hate to overstate it by saying he simply didn't know what he was doing. How many people who are elected to the presidency automatically know what they're doing? I mean, you can go back through our history and name almost all of them. That's what you come up with. So, and then, of course, Bay of Pigs illustrates graphically to the world that he doesn't know what he's doing, that he, you know, has made this terrible mistake. So Khrushchev has very little reason to fear him, has very little reason to worry about, whatever Kennedy says. He's going to do what the Russians need to do, and it really doesn't matter.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's It's hard to compare to Eisenhower, to be fair. But yeah, that's a really fair comparison. And I was curious about this idea. You wrote about how there was change going on inside the Soviet Union at the time that Kennedy was elected in 61. And this was roughly 8 years after Stalin died. Do you think things would have turned out differently if Stalin had still been alive and in charge? Would the crisis have happened or escalated to that point?
I hate to think what things would have been like if Stalin had still been alive. I mean, he was, in many ways, I mean, he was a madman. I mean, I love the story that in the late 1930s, he fired all his generals because they were the threat, the potential threat to him. And of course, then the Germans invade Russia and he's got no generals. So, I mean, that's sort of a mood. It doesn't show a great grasp on world situations. It shows a grasp of his own personal situation. He dies in 1953. And as happens every time in Russia, there is a power struggle there. You know, they don't have free elections. They have different people sort of maneuvering around each other to try to come out on top to be the next premier. Khrushchev wins. And so he's the all powerful. I mean, he's the last word. And again, that's a concept that, has never really existed in the Western Hemisphere, but it exists in Russia. And it still does. I mean, to a certain extent, to a definite extent, it still does. And, again, that's something we have to take that into consideration when we're dealing with him, because he's the boss. Whatever he says goes, and whatever decisions he makes are the decisions. So it's a whole different situation than when you're dealing with JFK and the XCOM group and all these like 20 or 30 advisors, all of them arguing, talking to Kennedy, trying to come up with the best idea. Khrushchev doesn't have any of that. He's got the general or the field marshal, who's a member of the Presidium, who comes to him and this guy wants to blow up the world. He's like gung-ho. His counterpart in the United States, Curtis LeMay, who's the Air Force chief of staff, he wants to blow up the world. I mean, he tells Kennedy, let's launch the missiles now before they catch up to us. That's where the phrase comes from. It's a winnable war. The winnable part of it is we will have no more than 40 to 60 million casualties, but we'll come out on top.
Yikes.
Yeah.
That doesn't
especially work. But from Khrushchev's point of view, he's got that guy pushing them from one direction, but he's also, surprisingly, he's got peace people in the Presidium who are, who say, no, don't do this, who argue with him about the missiles in Cuba. This is a bad idea, but he does it anyway.
He seemed definitely balanced out a little bit. He wasn't like a maniac. That's interesting because in the U.S. you have things like, okay, there's elections every so-and-so years, either in the Congress or for the president. But this guy Khrushchev, which is totally crazy to think about from an American point of view, this guy's on top because he won the Thunderdome. He's on top because he won the Thunderdome and everyone will listen to him. And he's not just going to be replaced in 2 years by someone. So that is kind of terrifying.
I mean, and more evidence for that is if you look at what happens to Khrushchev after the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, he is widely seen by his own Presidium as you're weak. You gave it away. And they're right. I mean, Khrushchev knows they're right. And it takes a couple of years. But then Brezhnev comes along, who's the next strong man. And Khrushchev is out. Mm. And he's allowed to live out his life. Interestingly,
Khrushchev writes
memoirs, which are fabulous. Okay. I mean, it has a big, thick book like this. His son, Sergei, smuggled the manuscript out of Russia because the Russians did not want to publish it. So it's published in English in this country. Sergei Khrushchev, Khrushchev's son, was an American citizen and lived in Rhode Island.
Oh, my God.
He just passed away about 2 or 3 years ago.
What?
But he did us a wonderful service by bringing us that manuscript, because that, there it is. You want to know what what's going through Khrushchev's mind? There it is.
Amazing. Yeah, I'd love to read that. That's amazing. It's always really cool when you find these firsthand accounts like that, and that it was smuggled out. Awesome. Okay, now I'm going to have to go check that out. I did want to ask, so let's talk about Castro for a second. He was starting to, so the revolution happened, and there's this kind of idea that the revolution wouldn't have happened without Russian interference. And so where there's already this like tension there with that. Can you tell us a little bit about Operation Mongoose?
Yeah, the JFK, again, this is another CIA thing. They handed JFK. The Kennedys, JFK and Bobby, they hate Castro. That's never really explained why. To the extent that they hate him. And so the idea is the CIA is only too happy to jump in and say, oh, we'll take him out. We'll assassinate him. So they come up with the dumbest set of ideas of what they're going to do to Castro. One, they recommend putting a seashell on the beach with explosives in it. So when Castro comes along, he likes to listen to the ocean. I mean, there's one. On and on and on. I mean, they're just amazing. I mean, it's like Peter Sellers is doing this. Just amazingly dumb ideas. And finally, it gets to the point where Kennedy realizes, especially once the Cuban Missile Crisis happens, we have bigger problems, and they also assume incorrectly that the Cuban people, which is the whole point of the Bay of Pigs, send these guys in, the Cuban people are going to rally around them. Yes, yay, we're going to get rid of Castro. It doesn't happen. And the idea that, that's going to happen still sort of permeates the CIA a little bit. But then, I'm sorry, how long was Castro around? How many decades? Clearly, that was never a possibility.
And that's what the exploding cigar, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
That was that one.
Poison pen, the whole thing.
So ridiculous. So silly.
It's like right out of a bad James Bond movie.
Kind of funny. It seems like the 1960s spy TV thing, which is from that era. That's really ridiculous. Can I ask, what was Berlin's involvement in the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, there had been a crisis in Berlin early on when the Russians, after World War II, a lot of people don't realize the Americans had nothing to do with taking Berlin. Hitler in his bunker and all of the stories you hear, that was the Russians. The Russians did all that. We went south, Patton. We were down in Czechoslovakia, down in that area. So the Russians capture Berlin. And rightly so, they occupy it, and they occupy it with a fair amount of force. And that goes on, and we try to help. I love the story, and I don't know all the details of this, but there's a candy drop. Now, the Berlin airlift, where we go in with planes, we go overhead, and we drop, with parachutes, all this stuff for the kids, for the children. I don't know whose idea that was. I really don't know. But, it's a great idea. Well, that was fine. I mean, the Russians didn't have much of a problem with that. So, Kennedy comes into office and there's nervousness about, because we're there. I mean, we've agreed at this point, there are now, the British, the French, and the Americans have, checkpoints in Berlin as part of a treaty we have with the Russians. And the Russians, of course, are on the other side. And there's the nervousness among everybody that somebody's going to do something stupid. Some Ooh. Tank commander is going to look Ooh. At the guy across the way and go, oh, I can take him out. Something dumb like that. And then Kennedy's very nervous about that. But then all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, over a course of a couple of days, the Russians build the Berlin Wall. I mean, it was a surprise to everybody. I mean, it's like you woke up the next morning and, whoa, there's a wall.
Quite shocking.
It's an amazing thing. But Kennedy, yes, on the one hand, this is terrible. This is a terrible thing. I wish we couldn't have allowed this, blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, it's like, ooh, there's a wall. That means there's very little chance that this tank commander is going to, shoot the other guy because there's a big concrete wall in front of him. So in a way, it settles things down. and it defines East Germany and West Germany. But it sort of calms down that whole attitude.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that, definitely. God, so many things happening at that point of time in the world. Big things. Berlin Wall is a huge thing. Cuban Missile Crisis is a huge thing. It's not a lot of downtime. I wanted to ask about, was it JFK that said that if Russia had been open and honest about, oh, hey, we're going to set up these missile sites and we're going to do military training in Cuba and all this stuff, then we wouldn't have had to spy on them, or it wouldn't have escalated. And I kind of personally feel like if they had been open and honest, it would have escalated quicker, almost.
There's a good way of examining that. I mean, first of all, we were spying on the Russians anyway. I mean, we had U-2s flying over, you know, over the Soviet Union. One of them gets shot down. The pilot, you know, Francis Gary Powers, who's put on display by the Russians as a big propaganda thing. And by the way, he becomes a traffic reporter in a helicopter in Los Angeles when all that's over with. But I mean, so the Russians are already saying, hey, you know, well, what is this? You're spying, you're sending spy planes over our territory. We start doing it as well over Cuba. And that's how, of course, we find the missiles. The U-2s and other spy planes come back with photographs. We're taking hundreds of thousands of photographs that are being broken down by CIA people, and they're analyzing every one. It's an incredible Herculean job to do this. And they figure out that, you know, and then they come into Kennedy with this big chart, and they say, see these photographs here? That right there is missiles. And I love that Bobby Kennedy says, it looks to me like a football field. It's like, okay, you say they're missiles. We have to take your word for it. But, the Kennedy realizes, first of all, there's another plane shot down over Cuba. And Kennedy gets really nervous. So he orders all the spy guys have to fly, cannot fly over Cuban airspace. They have to fly around the edge. And they can, they can photograph sideways. Well, it's not really effective, but that's what they do. And then also they go in, you know, we have these planes that are very low altitude and they fly like crazy. And they send those in because the Cuban anti-aircraft guys who are sitting there, they're like drinking a coffee or something, and these things come roaring over way quicker than they can get their guns ready. Those guys are taking pictures. So it's really, the whole thing it's fascinating. When you see what's involved, it's not simply the Americans telling the Russians, get out of Cuba. There's a lot of really interesting things happening.
Yeah, I don't see a scenario where we wouldn't be spying on them, whether or not they had been truthful to us. That was going to happen either way. Like you were saying, we were already doing it. So I want to ask one more question before we go. Things obviously de-escalated between the U.S. and Russia and over Cuba, and there was a treaty that was signed. Can you tell us a little bit about what was in that treaty?
Well, the treaty was not as important as what they didn't say, because the idea was, okay, yes, the Russians will get out of Cuba, and, you know, we agreed to not do this and this and this and this. But more importantly, and I love this, it's a scene with Bobby Kennedy and the Russian ambassador. They make a deal where we will pull our missiles out of Turkey, but we're going to be very quiet about it because the American public and the military might not like that. But Kennedy was, the JFK was upset when he found out. He didn't even know the missiles were there. He said, yeah, because he had been given an order to remove them because they were obsolete. They were junk. So now we're looking at each other quietly and saying, we were going to get rid of those things anyway. This is great. And that's exactly what happened. So a few months after everything settles down, we go over to Turkey quietly and pull the missiles out, which satisfied the Russians. I mean, they're happy with that. But it didn't save Khrushchev because he's still seen by his own people as weak, and that he lost, you know, this particular confrontation.
I can understand that. From that point, from the Russian point of view, you could understand that. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all of these questions. Before I go, I do want to ask, is there anything that we can expect from you in the future? Any other books that you're working on?
Actually, I just finished a manuscript that it'll be in New York in about a week. It's a novel on Lincoln. And noted Lincoln historians, a couple of really very good friends of mine, told me, they said, you need to do this. Nobody's ever done it. You know, nobody's ever had, you know, where you have, Mary Todd Lincoln and, you know, her attitude toward her husband, her point of view, Seward's point of view. I finished the bulk of it. It's a big
thing. Really?
But all I need to do, I need to write an afterword and an introduction, and then it goes off to New York.
This is basically done.
A year away from coming out.
Okay.
Things have changed in publishing. Mm. I used to be able to turn in a manuscript in January, we'd edit it by February, and it would be out in May.
Okay.
Not anymore.
Really?
They say Amazon and Barnes & Noble, they want a lot of lead time now for marketing. So, there's nothing I can do about it, but as long as I do my job, then I can go on to something else. It was exciting to write this, to get into Lincoln's head, because you talk about, somebody told me, I don't know how accurate this is, 20,000 books written about Lincoln. And yet, told me in New York, in the publishing world, every publisher wishes they had a Lincoln book every year because they sell.
What?
Yeah, we'll see. You know, this is a unique sort of endeavor. We'll see if it works. I had fun doing it, and I hope it's good.
And you actually get to, you talk about his wife, Aunt Mary Todd. She is fascinating, everything she went through and what happened to her at the end of her life. Like that, you actually get to go into her head a little bit.
Yeah, the best word I can think of, and I use this in the story, the best word I can think of to describe Mary Todd Lincoln is mercurial. She's all over the place emotionally. She's crushed by the death of her son, Willie, while Lincoln's president. And then, she loves going to New York and spending a fortune buying, everything she can buy at every shop on Fifth Avenue. And then she comes back and she's angry. She's mad at him and mad at the help in the White House and all. You know, so it's really kind of funny to write from her point of view because she goes through a lot. And, of course, she goes through a lot at the end, which is worse. And that sort of destroys her life. I mean, after Lincoln's gone, up until, 1866, 1867, she's a mess. And
tragic.
She's broke because the Congress will not give her any kind of pension or anything. It's a real mess. And
I think about her sometimes randomly, just everything that happened to her at the end. I'll just be like, oh, no, Mary Todd, they're so sad. So that'll be interesting to see what you write about all of that. So, that's really cool. Thank you again so much. And I hope to have you on again when that book comes out.
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay, bye.
Bye.